My name is Arbutus O'Neill. And it is by the grace of God that I belong to the all-known family group. I am powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over people and over things and almost all circumstances. And this is something that I have to admit and accept every single day of my life, a life that is unmanageable without the daily practice of the principles of a program that was given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety. I think that I would begin this evening by expressing my appreciation for those of you who are here, and by expressing my appreciation for the fact that this is an open meeting. I believe that it is in open meetings that we are best able to reach the people who need the Al-Anon Family Group program. I hope there are some people here tonight who do not go to Al-Anon Family Group program. Some people who go to conventions such as this and to open meetings with the AA spouse, but who do not really know the joy and the privilege of literally putting a family back together again in the Al-Anon family groups. I hope there are some people here tonight who live with active alcoholics and who do not know where to go to find the courage necessary to live with these very sick people. And I want to tell you that you're most welcome and there is hope in the Al-Anon family group program. For those of you who live with these sick people who may never stop drinking. I hope there's some people here tonight who are finding themselves a little bored with our program, who are beginning to feel a little complacent or perhaps useless in the structure of our fellowship. I want to do two things here this evening. I want to comfort the disturbed. And I want to disturb the comfortable. It's been my privilege and great joy to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups. And I'm exceedingly proud of this. A little while back, I discovered that this is just a polite way to call one of us a slow learner, but I'm still proud. And every time I talk to a group of people, I am again conscious of the fact that every one of you are here for exactly the same reason that I'm here. We were driven here under the cruel lash of alcoholism because we had nowhere else to go. Alcoholism is not new. It's as old as time. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it, and Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I've been able to learn, in other generations, seemed to be able to do anything about alcoholism. The priests and the ministers were baffled at their inability to cope with this dreadful malady, this insidious habit, if you please. They preached to the alcoholic. They prayed over them. Some of them forced them to sign pledges. And when these things failed, they damned his soul to hell. The men of science in other generations wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking. And failing to do this, they said to the young medical students before our time, "Don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless." Preachment failed and there was no cure, so there was only one other thing they needed to do with the alcoholic. He must be punished. So they locked you up in jail. The longer you drank, the longer you stayed in jail. And the longer you stayed in jail, the more you drank when you were released. It became a vicious circle. They tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. We'll never know how many sick alcoholics died in the jails across our country at the hands of sadistic jailers. And society permitted this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. But there was one group of people who never quite gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We bailed you out of jails. We picked up your hot checks. We pled with judges. We said, John's a good man when he's sober. And to complete this ridiculous paradox, we gave the alcoholic hell every time he got drunk. And society was puzzled that we continued to love and care for the alcoholic. There were some people that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people. They felt sorry for us. They almost killed us with their pity. They gave us nice shiny halos to wear, and we accepted them quite willingly. I put mine on every morning when I put on my lipstick. It was called self-righteousness. What was yours called?
Never mind.
You can find these halos discarded now in almost any Al-Anon family group meeting you care to attend. We don't wear them anymore. We don't need them. And I would like to tell you, we did not find them very comfortable. There was another group of people who thought we were plain fools to live under such circumstances. My mother came in this group. She used to say, God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our Butis and Bill. And Mother was right, God did look after us. And then more recently, since the professionals have got into the act, they seem to feel that we're masochistic. Now, that's a 12-cylinder word that means we like to suffer. And I cannot tell you which of these people are right. I guess it depends on which side you're on. And then society was puzzled by one other very, very significant fact. Many very brilliant, talented people are alcoholics. And it was these brilliant, talented ones who held the attention of an indifferent society until help came along for the rest of us. Did you ever stop to think about that? Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. He had conquered the whole known civilized world when he was only 33 years old. And he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he could not conquer his desire to drink, and he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. The sweet singer of songs who gave the world its most beautiful folk music was a compulsive drinker. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said, and so it does. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself in the magic that he found in a bottle. It could have been a fifth of gin or a quart of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of an alcoholic in a story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my own living room. Some of you saw it too. You saw the bottle change the man you love, or your beautiful wife, into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into a Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde. Now, history says little about these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the loneliness and the fear that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his Jeannie with the light brown hair. But the love of his wife could not stop his drinking, and he died drunk. They found him sick unto death on a New York battery. And when he was dead, they found in his pockets exactly 38 cents. and the lyrics to a new song. The love of his wife could not keep him sober. And I believe that I know the homesickness that Fanny Stevenson knew when she left her home in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He was also tubercular. And I believe that I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I think that I know the serenity that they both knew when he found sobriety. But you see, in our generation, it is no longer necessary for a man to die in drunken ignorance, as did Stephen Foster. Nor is it necessary to go to a South Sea island to find sobriety. It's as close to you as the nearest AA member. And these self-same people who in other generations before our lifetime are doing a great deal about alcoholism. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too. And they send them to AA for treatment. And they send their families to us so they can get well too. County judges now send alcoholics to AA instead of sending them to jail. We have wonderful rehabilitation programs in our federal penitentiaries under the auspices of AA for the rehabilitation of the alcoholic. National Council on Alcoholism is at this month involved in a tremendous public relations campaign teaching the public about alcoholism. Magazines and newspapers write articles about alcoholism. And all these things are wonderful. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I would not low rate the good intentions of our friends in the profession. But I must say this to you who are here tonight. We're not getting the job done. I do not feel that our friends in the professions know all there is to know about alcoholism. But when I look at a group of people like I see before me tonight, I am looking at a whole room full of experts. You all know about alcoholism because you've lived with it. You know the behavior of the alcoholic. You know about alcoholic convulsions. Some of you know the terrors of DTs. You know the alibi system. You know about slips in AA. There isn't very much about alcoholism that you do not know because you have lived with it. So in my opinion, this is a job for you to do. A job for you and for me. And I learned this a long time ago. You know, I came into this outfit of ours before we had an outfit. I came in to this fellowship when we didn't have a name. We didn't have one single scrap of literature, and we did not have hardcovered books and 52 pieces of literature that you Al-Anons take so for granted now. We didn't have anything at all. Didn't have any literature. We didn't have a program. We didn't have a purpose. All we had was a very dubious permission of a few new AA members to come to the clubhouses while they had a meeting. Now, it was important for us to come to the clubhouses because some of those fellows had long since lost their driver's license and they had to have a driver. So we came to the clubhouses and they allowed us to warm our hands at the blaze of their goodness, providing we keep the clubhouse clean and make the coffee. And I have to be a little defensive, I'm afraid, about these early groups because had we not been there, you wouldn't be here now. And not having any literature of our own, we did exactly what the AA members did. We had the big AA book. And the dear people who wrote this big AA book knew that in time, the families of alcoholics would become aware of their need for this program. I sometimes say that Al-Anon family groups are a kissing cousin to invention because they were both born of necessity. And we did become aware of our need for this program. And the people who put your book together included in this book two chapters for the families. One of them is entitled To the Wives. Now, this does not in any manner of means mean to put down our wonderful men in Al-Anon, because at that time there were no women sober in AA. So they simply entitled this chapter to the wives. And the other chapter is entitled to the family afterwards. So down in my part of the country, we took a paragraph out of this chapter and we made of it a little preamble that we used to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the alcoholic's family, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. Now, I am exceedingly proud of the tremendous supply of literature that we have at this moment. I'm grateful for every single piece of it. But I cannot, in all conscience, think of one single piece of literature that we have that quite so clearly defines what my responsibility is to families of alcoholics. Nor do I think we have one single piece of literature that so clearly points out to me how I can show my gratitude for the sobriety in my own home and for the good things that this sobriety has brought to me. And I think furthermore that this paragraph should make any one of you active in Al-Anon. This single paragraph has literally caused me to travel thousands of miles and talk to hundreds of people. And I hope that those of you who are coming in now will feel so impelled. And I would like to point out something else. Do not be frightened at the enormous task before you, because you need no special training. You simply need a compassionate heart and the willingness to share. We don't use this particular book as much in the Al-Anon meetings anymore as we used to, and I think this is regrettable. We have condensed this paragraph now, and we simply say in our meetings, we share our experience, strength, and hope one with the other in love. And I know why I was invited over here tonight, to share my experience, strength, and hope with those of you who are here. And that's what I shall try to do for the next few minutes. I attended my first AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948, and I did not want to go to this meeting. And to point out to you a little earlier that you're going to hear my Bill talk to you tomorrow. And my Bill had found AA in 1945, and it took him 6 years to make 1 year of sobriety, and I did not want to be associated with this kind of people. I didn't know much about alcoholics in those days, and I could see no constructive purpose to be served in associating ourselves with a group of people who, by their own admission, had ruined everything they'd ever tried to do. They'd ruined their own health. They'd ruined their lives. They had lost their families. They'd lost their businesses. Some of them had done terrible things and had been in jail, and I did not want to associate with this kind of people. I was having quite enough trouble, thank you. A very fine Al-Anon member from the West Coast described me long before she ever met me. She says that there comes to meetings out on the West Coast people who are just two jumps ahead of a fit. And that's how I got here. Just two jumps ahead of a fit. This was an open meeting that I attended. There was about 100 people there. And after the meeting had started, a very lovely lady that I learned later was a member of AA leaned across the little lady that had insisted on me going to the meeting. Her name was Marguerite. And this AA lady whispered to me, and what she said was, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" So you see, I wasn't in such a good shape. To be quite frank with you, I weighed about 107 pounds in those days, and when you're as tall as I am, that's pretty thin. And I was just about as gray as I am now. I haven't changed much. But I was not embarrassed by the lady's question. I hesitated a moment to answer it because I wanted to remember when I'd had a drink. I'm not a teetotaler. I'm not sure I trust teetotalers. But Marguerite was terribly embarrassed, and so she said to the lady, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism." I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My dad was a two-fisted construction man. He worked hard, he played hard, and he drank hard. Dad was a gray-eyed Irishman. He taught me to love poetry. He taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, he turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. It turned my lovely mother into an old, ugly woman who hated my father. She still hates him, and he's been dead over 6 years. Dad was one of those who never found this program, and he wanted to. Most desperately, he wanted to. He used to come to Texas after Bill came into AA, and he would go to AA meetings with us, and when we'd come home from these meetings, he'd ask us a question. I've never found anybody who was able to answer Dad's question, and I don't expect you can answer it either. And what he would say to us was this: "How do you get the want to?" Dad never found the want to, so he never found the program. And after I gained the courage to ask the God of my understanding for special privileges, I used to close every single day of my life with one special prayer: "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Now, I cannot tell you why this is so terrifying to those of us who love alcoholics. I can only tell you that it is. God, don't let my dad die drunk. When my father died over 6 years ago, he died of throat cancer. He did not die drunk. I did not tell you these things about my father that you may weep for him. My father's all right. You see, he doesn't have to drink anymore. I tell you these things about my father, that you may know that I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love the alcoholic, I want to restore his family. You see, I know something about alcoholics. I know that of all the things they love in the whole world, they love their families most. Even when they tear us down again and again and again, they love their families most. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. When I married my Bill, I was not concerned with his drinking. I drank with him. We worked for a company that sent us all over the United States, and we got drunk in every town we went to. We got drunk in Kalamazoo, Saratoga, Chicago, St. Louis, San Antonio. Everywhere we went, we got drunk. All the people that worked for this company were about the same age. And it seemed exceedingly important in my generation to have fun. I think this new generation's kind of working on the same system. And we had so darn much fun, it almost killed us. And then in 1940, two things happened to make Bill and me grow up. We became parents. And the world became involved in a war. I didn't drink with Bill anymore. Things were too serious. Our second child was born the next year, and Bill was not there when Nancy was born. Nancy came on Wednesday, but she didn't meet her father till Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that you men seem to feel it's necessary to bring to your wives when we have your babies, he caused a great deal of confusion in the hospital. You see, he wanted to teach the Catholic nun, who was in charge of this maternity ward in the Good Samaritan Hospital in Cincinnati, Ohio, of all places, the taxi stop. And the good sister didn't want to dance. And when he left the hospital that afternoon, at the insistence of the doctors and with the help of two big burly orderlies, he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window, forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. Our only son came the next year, and this time the trip to the delivery room was a little bit different. They needed Bill, and they couldn't find Bill. Now, had they asked me, or had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them that Bill was in a bar, but you see, I didn't know which one. And my good friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of town. But I believe I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife. When she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. And the crawling fingers of loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child. And you hear her cry for her daddy. I want my daddy. You can't find her daddy. This, I believe, is loneliness. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. That little boy was a frail child. The doctors told us he'd never walk. Alcoholics are sensitive people. I've watched Bill stand by this child's crib for long moments, this golden-haired little boy of ours who couldn't kick and go get drunk. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. Our fourth child, another little girl, was born in 1943. And by this time, the drinking had progressed, and Bill had started having personality clashes with the people he worked for, and he changed jobs pretty often. One of these jobs took us down to Knoxville, Tennessee, I recall. This was the beginning of the war, and places were hard to get. I don't like to tell this part of the story. If you haven't discovered by now, I'm a hillbilly. And hillbillies don't like to be beholden. But during this time that we lived in Knoxville, we were evicted from a house that rented for $50 a month for non-payment of rent. At the same time that my husband was earning $500 and $600 a week in commission from the Holland Furnace Company. Bill said, I should tell this part of the story because it might mean something to you high-bottom drunks. When I tell this story, it sounds endless. But this did not happen over a long period of time. It happened quickly. One day, this boy was on top of the heap, pulling down a good salary with a good company. No problems as far as finances was concerned, and the next day we were being evicted from a house because we couldn't pay our rent. This was not the first of the eviction, the last of the eviction notices that I was to see. And each time that these eviction notices were served, I saw on the faces of those who served them the looks of pity and disgust. And then I was forced to go to a welfare agency for help for my children. And this isn't easy for a hillbilly, but you'll do it. You'll go to a welfare agency to feed your children and to get treatment for your young son. And again, I saw the look of pity and disgust on the face of the social worker when she wrote on the application blank, "Husband is a drunkard." Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I would like you to know that when I went to the state of Texas, some 27 years ago it is now, I had never heard this term in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever heard this term used in reference to his drinking. Bill lost his eye as a result of drinking, and he couldn't quit. He lost his arm as a result of drinking, and he couldn't quit. He almost died as a result of drinking, and he could not quit. And I watched this happen, and I couldn't help him. And I wanted to help him with every fiber of my being. And I want to say something directly to you people in the room tonight who are alcoholic and members of AA. I have seen many of you and heard many of you stand behind podiums like this around the country and have the unmitigated gall and the asinine arrogance to say a non-alcoholic don't know what they're talking about. And I want you to know that I know what I'm talking about. I've had my own father beat me black and blue, killing spiders that only he could see. My father loved me. I was his firstborn. Scared to death he wouldn't live. And scared to death that if he did live, that he would not have any mind left. I watched the sanity leave his eyes until I didn't know which eye was artificial. And I've worked with alcoholic women, so my hair and my skin reeked with the odor of formaldehyde. And I go on record as saying there's nothing with the nauseous odor of formaldehyde. And I've gone home grateful in the knowledge that but for the grace of God somebody might be walking me up and down and feeding me black coffee to send my own children to school. I know what I'm talking about. It seems to me that you put us on the other side of a thick glass wall, and we can see you and we can hear you, but we can't get through to you because you won't let us. I know the mental anguish of the alcoholic. I know the physical torture. We're not unfeeling, callous people. And I go on record of saying that this torture that you must endure, don't hold a light to this hopeless feeling of inadequacy that those of us who love you must endure week after week, month after month, sometimes year after endless year. It doesn't hold a light. I think those of you who are parents know this feeling to a degree. It's the feeling that you have when you tend a sick child and you want to help the baby. The baby's burning up with fever and it cries and you want to help, but you can't. Because the baby can't tell you where it hurts. And the alcoholic couldn't tell us where they hurt, and we couldn't help them. But we wanted to. Some of you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people like me. And I hope the next time that you want to say this, that you will remember that we wanted to help you, but you wouldn't let us. Have you ever tended an injured animal, a dog with a broken leg perhaps? It bites you? That's what you did to us. Some of us will go through hell backward for you. So please remember, it wasn't because we didn't want to. When you indict the family of the alcoholic, know within your heart that we wanted to help you, but you wouldn't let us. And it was because of this unholy compulsion that gripped my young husband that completely and utterly demoralized not only my Bill, but me and my children, that we started on what I like to call a new kind of education. Now, in the pursuit of this education, we met many people, and we learned many things. The first of these people that we met, of course, were the AA members. And I never shall forget the first AA member that I ever talked to. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon, this fine man, and he told me about what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program for the alcoholic. And I was interested and excited about it. And after about 2 hours, I asked him a question. I said, what do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics? And no one had ever asked him this question before, and he couldn't answer it. And he looked at me and he said, "We don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem." My God! At that moment, I couldn't wear sleeves on my arms because of a rash that the doctor said was caused by nerves. I was literally so nervous that I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And this good AA member said to me, "You do not have a problem." And I thought he was wrong. And I still think he was wrong. And I believe with all my heart that it was at that moment that I made up my mind subconsciously that someday, somehow, I would find a way to help the families of alcoholics, and by the grace of God, that opportunity came to me. Because then, you see, I met another group of people. Now, Bill Wilson says this is a very, very special group of non-alcoholic people whose lives have been most dreadfully affected by the disease of alcoholism. These people entertain the same fears as does the alcoholic. These people cultivate the same self-pity as does the alcoholic. And these people develop the same personality defects as does the alcoholic. There is only one difference. These people do not have the allergy to alcohol, and that's the most revolting development of all, because this simply means that we cannot find escape in a bottle. This simply means that we have to take our punishment standing up, cold, sober, and there's not an alcoholic among you that can do it before you find AA. And I seem to know these people. Some of these people seem to have been born with an understanding heart, and the rest of these people seem to have developed this understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I was drawn to these people. It didn't take a psychologist to make me understand that these people knew what was wrong with me. These people could give me courage to face life one day at a time. These people could make my life a little bit better simply because they were there. And as I told you a moment ago, they didn't even have a name. In time, of course, they were to be called the Al-Anon Family Groups. You know, there's a difference between the member of the Al-Anon Family Groups and the member of AA, in case you have not noticed. In order for an alcoholic to become a member of AA, he has to quit, or she has to quit. But there is not any quitters in the Al-Anon Family Group. What becomes of them, I do not know, God bless them, but they don't make it to Al-Anon because, you see, we don't know how to quit. We don't quit hoping. And we don't quit helping the alcoholic. Now, our methods get a little drastic, I have to admit to that. But most important of all, we don't quit loving the alcoholic. What becomes of the quitters, I do not know, but they do not make it to the Al-Anon Family Groups. And when I came to these people, I was completely and utterly destitute in all ways you can imagine, and let your imagination go where you will. I had no faith in God. I could not trust people. And I did not believe that AA would work. And that's just about as hopeless as you can get. I had no confidence in my husband's sobriety. And this in itself is utter and complete destitution. Oh, I knew there was a God. Don't misunderstand me. I knew there was a creator of the universe, if you please, who made the world and changed the seasons and turned the nights into day and hung up the stars to make it pretty for us. And I thought that he put people here and then he let us go to hell backwards. But I did not know that God had any concern or interest in me. I know now, of course, that I tried to pray when I was cold and scared and sometimes hungry. And I know now, of course, that he heard me. I think God listens very carefully for the prayers of the beginners and for the prayers of the alcoholic. I think he knows that we do not have the courage to speak aloud sometimes. And I think that he knows that we do not have the words that prayers are made of, so he listens very carefully. And I know now that he heard me when all I could do is say, "Oh, God." And I know that he knew why I couldn't trust people. You see, people do not deal very kindly with the families of alcoholics. I couldn't even trust myself. I was not responsible for what I did, and I was not responsible for what I said. Now, I'd like to make another point very clear to you. I did not come here to get my husband sober. I know that's the way a lot of people get to the Al-Anon family group programs, but I did not come here to get my husband sober. I came here to try to find the disintegrated pieces of a personality that once was me. And back in the mid-40s and the early 50s, you will recall, there was a great many articles being written about group therapy in the field of mental health. And I thought this is what the family groups was. And in a sense, that's what it is. So I came to the meetings, and I listened with tongue in cheek, I'm afraid, when they spoke of prayer and meditation, because I didn't believe them. And I came here because our four children were more afraid of me than they were of their daddy when he was drunk, and with good reason. I punished them unmercifully if they spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth, and I insisted on the white tablecloth. Now, I'm sure a psychologist could make much of this, but I didn't understand it. It did not make sense to me that you'll try to prove to your own children that you're an aristocrat, but I did it. If they made a C on a grade card, they were afraid to bring it home because I would not tolerate failure. Failure had been bred out of me. And I think that basically and subconsciously again, I thought that this very likely was the deep basic reason for alcoholism, and I didn't want to raise a drunk. And my husband was ashamed of me. And I didn't want my husband to be ashamed of me, and I did not want my children to be afraid of me. And so that's why I came here. And they told me in that early group that if I would put the principles of this program to work in my life, that it would change. And without believing them, that's just exactly what it did. And they told me that I should start working the 12 steps. And it never entered my mind to ask, which way do you go? I thought you're supposed to start with one and work down through 12. I hear people talking about working up through 12 now, but Bill Wilson says you don't. You work down to humility. And I thought that's the way it should be done, and so that's what I started doing, working down the 12 steps, putting these principles to work on me. And I can't stand up here tonight and tell you that overnight I became a wise and wonderful woman, because this obviously is not the truth. But I can tell you that my life did change. I think the first thing that I noticed was that the children could relax around me. They finally became so relaxed that they sighed. And then I became aware of the fact that once again Bill was proud of me, and this is exceedingly important to those of us who love alcoholics, and I think I know the reason for it. You see, in our culture, in our society, about the lowest man on the totem pole in our social structure is a drunk. That's about as low down as you can get. But then you rejected us. So this need for approval lies deep within all of us, a very sick need for approval. And I was glad when I became aware of the fact that Bill once again was proud of me. These things are exceedingly important to me, but not nearly as important as the fact that I belonged to something. You see, I'd never belonged anywhere in my life. I grew up in construction camps around this country. And the first thing that my dad would do when we'd move into these camps was build a fence around our place. Now, there was a reason for this fence, and it was not to keep the Martin children in. It was to keep the other people out. And this makes for a very lonely childhood. So I grew up without belonging anywhere. I didn't belong to a community because we didn't live there long enough. We built up your community and we moved. I didn't belong to a church because you don't go to church when you don't believe in God. I didn't belong to a school because I didn't go to one more than one semester till I was high school age. Now I belong to the most wonderful thing in the world. It's called the Al-Anon Family Group. And I meet some of the most tremendous people everywhere I go. And then I was elected to serve on the World Service as a World Service Conference delegate from the state of Texas back in 1960. And I was privileged to go to New York and attend the World Service Conferences. And I met Bill Wilson and his wife, Lois. And I met the other delegates. And I became aware that I had friends all over the world. And some of you told me that you liked me. And then I could belong to the human race. And more recently, of course, you've given me the blessed privilege of serving on the Board of Trustees for our fellowship. And this is a tremendous experience. And these things are exceedingly important to me. Exceedingly important to me. You gave me the tools to rear 4 well-adjusted children. And I sometimes forget to tell people this. This little boy of ours who was not expected to walk weighed into the Navy at 189 pounds. He's long since served his stint in the Navy, and he lives in Austin, Texas now, has a beautiful home, a little business of his own, and a pretty little wife. All of our daughters are married. We have 8 grandchildren. And this could not have been my story had it not been for this program. Out in Colorado last year, I heard an Alateen sponsor giving the kids a hard time and telling them about all the bad things that was going to happen to them because their parents were drunk, and it just burned me up. You can be anything you want to, and it doesn't matter whether your dad or mother's a drunk. My dad was a drunk. My children's father was a drunk. He found AA. 2 of my daughters are special education teachers, and I have to believe that they're better teachers because they know of this program. Our youngest daughter got her degree after she was married. I never did get a degree that said O'Neill. All of them said something else. Teresa got her degree after she was married, and she was graduated magna cum laude. That's not bad for a drunk kid. And all of these things were possible because I found you and because I found this program. But they told me way back there, when I first came here, that I could have these things so long as I was willing to give them away. And there's a condition, you know. Our program carries a message of hope that the whole world needs to know. And all of us know that hope will never die. It will burn low at times. And it's up to us to keep that flame of hope alive. And I never close a talk that I make without saying this to you. This program is something that you have to be responsible for. You and I are the ones who must carry the message of this program. Within a stone's throw of this very building, I venture to say, it's very probable that there's drunken men and women who will never know they're alcoholic if we fail to carry the message of this program. And there's men and women in this pretty little town, and in Dallas, Texas, and in every town that I know anything about, who will not have the courage to face life one more day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their home if we fail to carry the message of this program. And there's kids in this pretty little town, and in Dallas, Texas, and every other town that I know, kids who are scared for their dad or their mother to come home at night. Kids who will grow up with deformed personalities if we fail to carry the message of this program. And if we fail to carry the message of this program, may God have mercy on those people. And may God have mercy on us. Thank you.